I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, it's Ellen here, deputy editor of Prospect and the usual host of the Prospect podcast. This week, we're bringing you a special episode hosted by our contributing editor, Isabel Hilton. It's a great conversation on the environment and the war in Ukraine, but we did have some technical difficulties with the audio. Please accept our apologies, and we hope you enjoy the discussion.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect podcast. I'm Isabel Hilton, contributing editor at Prospect, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Margot Wahlström, who's done more distinguished jobs than I can possibly list after being elected to Parliament at just 25. She's a former Deputy Prime Minister, a former Foreign Affairs Minister in Sweden, and she's also been Environmental Commissioner in the European Union. But today we're talking about her role as co-chair of a high-level working group on the environmental consequences of the war in Ukraine. What that is, what they discovered, and what should happen now to hold Russia accountable. I've written about this for Prospect following a reporting trip to Ukraine that included Chernobyl, the nuclear power plant that blew up with devastating consequences. You can read that online or in the magazine. I spoke to journalists and Ukrainian officials about the painstaking process of documenting environmental destruction in an active war zone and how justice can ever be achieved for these ecological crimes. So I'm delighted that Margot has found time to talk to us about these issues today.
So, Margot, we last saw each other on a chilly railway station in Poland on the way back from that very memorable trip to Ukraine. And thank you so much for joining us today. I want to look at what led to that visit and what you thought might come out of it in the end.
Thank you very much, Isabel, for inviting me to this. And also thank you for coming with us. This really started with President Zelensky's speech to the G20 countries in November 22, when he noted that it was important also to address the problem with the environment and how war affects the environment in Ukraine. And since then, this international working group that I'm co-chairing together with Andriy Yermak, the chief of staff of President Zelensky, has dealt with three issues. First, to assess the situation. What kind of impact on the environment can we note from the war, since the war started? Secondly, what about accountability? How to make Russia pay for their war crimes, including their attack on the environment? And thirdly, what about rebuilding and doing reconstruction after such a devastating war? Of course, we wanted to see for ourselves, for example, what happens with nuclear energy facilities and also what goes on in Chernobyl at the moment. And we have visited three times. We visited Kiev and also talked to the president and to the government about what is happening.
So let's take those three issues separately. So let's look first at what been found. How do you examine? How do you discover what the environmental consequences of war are?
Well, there have been many reports about the impact on the environment by the World Bank, the European Union, the of course the environmental and non-governmental organizations in Ukraine, and that has served as a good sort of map of the damage done. And what we know, in short, is that people and animals are killed, that forest and nature is ravaged, that water and air and soil is polluted, that poisonous substances are released into the environment. And it is a very devastating picture and impression from all of this. A very, very serious situation. And of course, attacks like the one on the Kakhovka Dam means that it is also a massive devastation. And I think that these consequences will be felt for generations to come and to deal with. So this is the situation as it is now.
The Kakhovka Dam, for listeners who perhaps may not be unfamiliar, was one of Europe's biggest dams. It was under Russian control when an explosion breached the dam and the massive flooding of southern Ukraine followed, with toxic sludge and all sorts of parts of places. And that's a very, very visible and catastrophic event. There is a question, though, I guess, about damage. Of course, wars cause environmental damage. But evidentially, you talk a lot in the report about the question of how you collect evidence. And I suppose if I were the defending counsel in any putative court case, I would say, well, how do you know that damage was caused by the war? How do you know where's your baseline? All the kind of scrutiny that evidence in court would demand. How did you explore those issues?
Absolutely. Of course, we have called on experts and advisors to help us in mapping out these problems, but also we, in our recommendations, in our report to the president, we say that this is indeed a very important part of what has to start now, and that is collecting evidence. But remember, already now, this is prohibited by international law to attack the environment as well. And luckily, also, the ICC, General Prosecutor, has announced that he will be looking into how to apply existing laws to address the problems that have appeared in Ukraine. And we think that the Kakhovka Dam must be a very good case to make. So, of course, it can be difficult to find a baseline, but many of these acts are viewed as attacks on civilians and civilian sort of infrastructure. It's not for the military targets or objectives. And this is already prohibited according to international law. But this is also something that you can say about the war on Ukraine, that it is both archaic, very old-fashioned, but also the most modern in the terms of allowing for collecting evidence by satellite, by drones, by the fact that people can record in real life what goes on. And we have seen evidence of that kind. So of course, this should be done with the best available technologies and the best available methods, but they have to be developed. And there is still, I think this can be a result of our work, hopefully, that we will start to establish common norms and standards for measuring the war's impact on the environment. There exists no such standards as of today.
So this is, in a sense, a process which is still in its phases. Has there ever been previously a case of such a commission, such a high-level group, such an effort going on while the war continues, while the war is in progress?
No, I don't think so. I think this is why Ukraine is showing leadership at the moment on these issues. And this is what I think also we should tell the rest of the world, that this is such an important event, and and hopefully in several different ways this can become an example to the rest of the world. There have been cases before, both when it comes to paying for the damage, like Iraq, that actually was compensated. It took like 30 years or something, but you know, there is no time limit for these cases, and that's a good thing. But we need to make sure that it is speeded up, that we develop the best of methods and the best of standards as well. And I think UNEP has also declared that this is something that they want to be engaged in. So maybe we can bring together a group of experts that quickly can start to do this while this is going on in Ukraine, to start to document it and see, you know, what is it that we should measure? What kind of standards need to be set?
This is clearly a very important topic, but you said in an earlier observation, of course, that people are being killed. And there will be people listening to this who are thinking, well, you know, compared to the deaths of humans, compared to the terrible suffering that this war is costing, why are we talking about the environment?
The priority has to be the safety and dignity of human beings, of every Ukrainian child, woman and man. But it is increasingly obvious that these depend not just on the end of violence, but also on a healthy environment and ecological security. So we must fight for these two. So we have to understand that the Ukrainians, as well as the rest of us, we depend on what nature can give us. And we have to understand to make peace. We have to make peace with nature too. And like a few other countries, they are so heavily dependent on what their famous black soil can give to the world. And when this is hurt and destroyed as it is now, it can also create food insecurity in the rest of the world as well. And I think that also Ukrainians, they know this very well. And they also have a love for nature that I think is important to understand and capture in everything that we do.
It was very striking on that brief visit. I spoke to a number of journalists who were working with the Reckoning Project and, of course, Ukrainian officials in the Environment Ministry. And people are risking their lives to collect this evidence because much of the damage, of course, is very close to the front line and within range of artillery fire. So clearly there's a very strong feeling and a very strong effort in Ukraine on this issue. I just wanted to explore a bit more, but then it would be like this, the second leg of the report, which is the accountability. And we've touched on some of the fora where this might happen. But let's go back to the basics. How much agreement is there on the nature of the crime, if you like? Is it a crime against the environment? Is it an environmental crime as a war crime? Well, how do we define this? And are we agreed on how we define it?
Well, the Ukrainians have put a lot of emphasis on the need to get sort of ecocide recognized as a fifth sort of crime under the Rome Statute. Personally, I think that this is absolutely a good idea. I think we have learned so much more in the years that have passed since the 1972, when this was coined actually by Olof Palme. I think that it has been a very important work done trying to define it, to explain exactly what this is. And I think already, as it is a war crime defined under international law, the prerequisites are sort of too many, makes it very complicated to prove. And to have it as a standalone sort of crime would also make it possible to use in peacetime. So I think that this is sort of the advantages of the focusing on ecocide as a concept and as a new type of crime. Already, the Ukrainians have started to look at and explore cases according to their own legislation. They have it in their national legislation, so they are following up on these cases. And I think here also the rest of the world can help. A group of prosecutors that they have as advisor can help them. And meanwhile, we have to think about ecocide as a new crime under Rome Statute as maybe something more long-term that can be achieved, but working very diligently on as I said, collecting evidence, building these cases properly. So I think both what they're doing at home and how the international community can help will make it a strong case. Already, it is prohibited to attack civilian targets, and this is considered as such. Everybody understands that it will take maybe forever to try to get some of the Russian leaders to actually behind bars for their crimes. But this is also another thing that justice. It takes a long time, but the possibility is open eternally, so they cannot get away in the long run. But we of course see that it will be terribly difficult to get to these individuals at the top in Russia. But this has to be the aim of it and the objective.
So it may be, if you know, when looking back at the situation in 20 or 30 years' time, that because this war is being documented in its environmental consequences, because we are where we are in the international discussion on ecocide, because these fora exist, that in fact Ukraine may be the foundational case for the crime of ecocide or the environmental damage of war as a legal person.
I truly believe that. And of course, it looked as if we were taking on a task that looks like a mission impossible. You know, that we, to talk of peace in the midst of war, as Zelensky did, to give a voice to the voiceless, like animals and trees and all living nature, and also to put a price tag on what to Ukrainians and the rest of the world is priceless, like nature, and to bring justice also to a country that is ravaged by violent war crimes, and also to rebuild from rubble. So I think in all these aspects, they are leading the way at the moment, and we have to give them all the support and help and assistance that we can.
Do you think in the end that progress in this depends on a military victory?
No, I think their future depends on whether they feel that they can defend themselves against these attacks. All of these investments and all of these actions will have to happen anyhow. This has to be dealt with, because otherwise they cannot survive in a nation that wants to be free and independent and be able to defend its territorial integrity. And it is for them to decide when and how the war has to come to an end, if it is that, you know, they will agree in the end, or if it is sort of a military victory. But they have to decide about the future of their own country. But this has to be done anyhow, because if and when they choose their own path, and we hope, of course, that it is also a European path, then they will continue to depend very much on what they can produce and from what nature gives. And also their health, because this will affect their health There are serious problems with all, not least all the chemicals and toxic substances, but also the landmines. And that's another of the big problems that we've seen and that we are addressing, and saying also to removing these landmines has to happen in a way that takes the environmental impact in consideration.
The environment in Ukraine is not just important in Ukraine. It has global significance because of Ukraine's always a major grain producer, because of the fact that its rivers drain into the Black Sea, because, you know, it is a hugely important European environment. It has extraordinary biodiversity. It couldn't be more significant. The first part of this exercise, this three-part exercise, is well advanced. You've documented the damage. The accountability and the reconstruction remain in the future. What now for the Commission? What now for the high-level group?
Well, we have produced a report, or a compact, as it is called, and it is very compact. It has 50 recommendations that we say are very concrete. They are doable. We have promised to continue to assist in the implementation phase, because as with any legal act, it's only as good as its implementation. And this is where we are hoping to both mobilize the international community, but also other actors that we think are important. Reconstruction and rebuilding has already started. You may not think so, but this is, in spite of this war still going on, there is a lot being done and with investments in rebuilding the country. And that's why many of these actions have to be taken now, to make sure that they plan better, that they coordinate better, that they adopt strategies how to handle all of these things in a controlled way and environmentally friendly and sustainable way. I think that this is where we have recommendations also say that they have to increase their capacity to deal with this, and where the rest of the world can help, both with financial resources as well as with expertise or training. So there is a lot in there, we have said that at least maybe until the end of the year, we will make sure that we help them with the implementation as well.
So the work goes on. Margot, thank you so much for joining us, and wonderful to talk to you.
After the break, we'll talk more about ecological damage in Ukraine. But first, I'd like to tell you about the upgraded digital experience you can enjoy with the new Prospect app. Stay informed, stay engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. Read or listen anywhere, at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but it also includes audio narration, plus podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, available on iOS and...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Android. And thank you to Margot Wahlström for her insights on the environmental costs of the war in Ukraine. The war, of course, also has huge climate effects, both in the direct emissions from the fighting and in the climate costs of both the destruction and the future reconstruction. All this at a time when climate scientists are sounding ever more urgent alarms and warning that we may already be on the edge of serious climate instability. Dr. Gavin Schmidt, who's a climate scientist and director of NASA's Goddard Institute, has just published an article in the magazine Nature, sounding the alarm about a spike in heat last year that made 2023 the warmest year on Earth for 100,000 years. Atlantic Ocean temperatures soared, Arctic sea ice melted, but the whole thing, says Dr. Schmidt, came as a complete surprise to people who, like him, have long experience in the climate modelling that we rely on to predict our climate future. Gavin Schmidt joined me to discuss the implications of last year's heat. So, Gavin, I want to start off by understanding what modelling is. You know, how long have we been doing modelling? You know, what's it based on? What do we hope to learn from it?
So there's lots of different kinds of modelling, and we've been doing it since we've been doing science. So, but with respect to the climate, we've been thinking about global mean temperatures and the changes because of carbon dioxide or the internal variability because of El Nino and La Nina or volcanoes or something. We've been thinking about that, I would say, you know, maybe 40 or 50 years. And we're mostly quite good at it. If you look at the long-term predictions that we made in the 1970s, in the 1990s, in the 2000s, they've pretty much mapped out what in fact has happened, given that we were able to make pretty good estimates of what was going to happen to greenhouse gases. So those long-term predictions for increasing global warming, increasing intense rainfall, increasing heat waves, melting sea ice, et cetera, et cetera. Those are pretty good. We haven't really kind of come out of the spectrum or the spread of what those predictions have been. But there's other kinds of modeling that you might want to do that allow you to kind of dig in a little bit deeper to the ups and downs, the things that are not quite the trend. What are the impacts of a particularly strong El Nino? What are the impacts of a change in aerosol emissions? What are the impacts of changes in the North Atlantic or in the Southern Ocean or things like that? And for those, we use statistical models. You know, we look at the past data, we try and kind of pull out relationships out of that data, and then we kind of apply it to the next year or the next few years. We've been pretty successful at doing that. And that allows us, you know, at the end of every year, we have this big press conference and people ask us, well, why was it warmer than we expected? Why was it cooler than we expected? What was going on? Why was it this, that, or the other? And we can do that. And we've done that very successfully for, you know, many, many years until 2023.
So you're describing a process that has been under sort of, if you like, constant refinement with adjustments to data, with ever more accurate connections between expected outputs and outcomes and actual outcomes. And you were feeling very confident, it seems to me, until 2023. So what happened in 2023?
So we started off the year And we were in a La Nina pattern. So El Nino, La Nina, for folks that aren't really very familiar with that, is a pattern of warming and cooling in the tropical Pacific. And it's a kind of associated with a sloshing of warm water. Normally, it kind of all piles up near Indonesia and Australia. And then sometimes it kind of sloshes back and kind of pops up again near South America. And so El Nino is generally, I mean, it's related to when this kind of maximum warming sometimes pops up, and it happens around Christmas time. And so it's like the arrival of the Christ child, right? So it was called El Nino by the Peruvian fishermen who first noticed this phenomena many moons ago. And so what we found subsequently is that when we have an El Nino pattern, it's warmer near the eastern tropical Pacific, so kind of like the bit of water near the Galapagos, near South America, kind of stretches out. And that actually has a big impact on global temperatures, global rainfall patterns, and we're using that now to predict droughts and wildfire seasons and crop yields all around the world, from the American Southwest to Botswana to Noreste Brazil to Indonesia to Australia. So it has these big global impacts. And so the opposite of the El Nino is La Nina, right? Which is like just because it sounds good, and that's an anomalously cold patch right near South America, and that has similar but opposite patterns. It cools the climate. Where there was rain, there was drought. Where there was drought, there was rain. Those kinds of things all happen. And so at the beginning of 2023, we were in our third year of a La Nina pattern. And they don't generally last for much longer than that. We've had a few of these triple dip La Ninas in recent decades. We were expecting, I think the modeling of that system, they were expecting that to be the end, and we would kind of move into an El Nino phase in 2023, which in the end we did. But at the beginning of the year, we were in this La Nina phase. And what we've seen in previous years is that is usually pretty telling for what's going to happen for the rest of the year. So if you start off with a La Nina, you're generally going to be a little bit cooler than the trend. If you start off with an El Nino, you're generally a little bit warmer than the trend. And if you have a big El Nino, then that's very likely to give you a record-breaking annual year.
When you say a little bit, what does a little bit mean in temperature?
A little bit is, 0.1 degrees Celsius. I mean, so the variations of the global mean temperature are not massive on a year-to-year basis. We're looking at the long-term trend is about 0.2 to 0.3 degrees Celsius per decade. And then the ups and downs because of the weather and things like that is about, 0.1 to 0.5, 0.15, 0.2 maybe up and down over that trend. So the prediction then at the beginning of 2023 was that, well, yes, the long-term trends are going to continue, but you've got this kind of cooling effect at the beginning of the year, and that's probably going to keep you below the trend level. There's still a potential, because there is a trend, there's a potential for a record warm year, but we figured that the odds of that were about 20%. But then things started to happen quite strangely, right? So in March, we started seeing these record-breaking temperatures in the North Atlantic. And we're going, oh, that's interesting. Wonder what's going on there. By June, those record-breaking temperatures were global, right? So we were seeing the oceans warmest that we'd ever seen. And we haven't really seen an El Nino, right? So it kind of the La Nina had kind of faded. It was kind of neutral. People were predicting that there would be an El Nino later on that year, but it hadn't happened. And then, you know, a little bit later in the Northern Hemisphere summer, we start seeing very low levels of Antarctic sea ice. So this is in the Southern Hemisphere. It's their winter. And instead of growing to the large size that it normally does, it was record-breakingly low. And you're going, okay, well, that's interesting because that's totally on the other side of the planet from the North Atlantic, right? No, there's no real direct connection between those two things. We're going, okay. And then the El Nino started to kind of pop up. It was clearly there in July, and it got bigger in August, and it was there in September. But then we started seeing the global temperatures breaking the records June and July. In August. In September, it broke the record by a whopping half a degree, which, you know, doesn't seem like a lot, but it's a big deal for the planet. And it was like, whoa, what's going on here? October, the same thing. November, December. And now we're still with January, February, and March as well are all going to be record-breaking months. People said, oh, well, it's the El Nino. But it generally takes time for the El Nino signal to propagate around the world, right? Now, things don't happen instantaneously. And you generally expect there's like a 3 month or so lag. And so the temperatures that we're seeing now, February, March, they're what you expect given the El Nino that kind of peaked in December. But the stuff that happened before that, there's no antecedent for that. And we've looked in the climate models, those big complicated simulations. Does this ever happen in these climate models? The answer is no. Has this ever happened in the instrumental record, going back 150 years? The answer is no. What is going on? So we have that kind of first cut of what we normally would have thought we understood, and then suddenly it doesn't fit, and it doesn't fit by not a little bit, but by a lot, right? We're arguing about a few hundredths of a degree, but now, you know, we were seeing kind of mismatches of 0.2, 0.3 degrees, and that's very large for this. All these things are relative to something that is not always very easy to grasp, but these are big numbers for the planet.
So you have a sudden large variation, a sudden warming, an anomaly, as you put it, which you didn't predict in the models, which you can't explain in the models. So what do you conclude?
Well, so you say, okay, well, whatever we were using to explain, obviously it did happen, right? So there must have been a cause. So why did it happen, right? And so we start to think, well, what did we not include, right? Are there things that happened that were particular to this year that could skew things, right? So we are aware that there was a kind of a special volcano that went off at the beginning of 2021, the Hunga Hapai volcano, which was an underwater volcano right on the equator near Tonga in the South Pacific. And it had a plume that reached 56 kilometers into the atmosphere. It's hard to imagine how powerful an explosion needs to be to take water and mass and ash and volcanic debris and move it 56 kilometers way into the stratosphere. I mean, absolutely stunning. I mean, there's stunning visuals of this from the space station, and there's stunning impacts of this that we can see with remote sensing. So what it did was it put a lot of water vapor into the stratosphere, which is a very unusual thing. Mostly volcanoes cool the climate because they put sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. That sulfur dioxide makes little particles of sulfuric acid. Those particles are reflective, and so it actually provides a bit of a shield, and it cools the climate, right? So it had a little bit of that, and it had this massive amount of water vapor. And water vapor in the stratosphere is actually quite a powerful greenhouse gas, and so that would be a warming tendency to the climate. Now, these things slightly cancel each other out, but they're going to have slightly different paths through time, but it's certainly a potential thing. Okay, well, maybe we're seeing the effects of that. But when you put that through the models, when you put that, you know, you do the calculations and you balance the sulfate terms and the aerosols and you balance the stratospheric water vapor, it doesn't give you anything like enough. It gives you maybe a few hundredths of a degree, and the sign is still a little bit uncertain. Then there are changes in other drivers, you know. So maybe the methane has increased quite a lot, but you calculate the impact of that. Again, it doesn't work. Air pollution has gone down. So, you know, we've been drifting down with air pollution for, you know, the last 20 or so years. This is a good thing. But that air pollution was causing a cooling. So maybe it's gone down a little bit faster than we thought. And then that's actually caused a relative warming. And we're still looking into the data. But there was one particular kind of pollution that had a pretty abrupt change. But not in 2023, but in 2020, where the International Maritime Organization passed a rule that said that you had to use cleaner fuel for shipping. And that cleaner fuel had 80% less sulfur in it. And so that produces less air pollution for every, you know, ton of fuel that you end up burning. Produces the same amount of carbon dioxide, but it produces less sulfates. And so we can see that, bizarrely enough, because we can see ship tracks. So they're kind of like contrails for ships, and we can see that from satellites. And those are related to how dirty the fuel is. And it's the interaction between those sulfate particles and the clouds that are around that can produce extra clouds, low clouds, and they generally cool the climate. So if you reduce the amount of emissions, then you take away some of that cloud, and therefore you warm the climate. And so people have been quite exercised by that. Oh, well, it's obviously that. But again, when you look at this quantitatively, you put it in, you do the calculations, and then you see, okay, what impact is that going to have either locally or in the global mean? And again, it doesn't reach the size of the anomaly that we're trying to explain. And so you kind of line up all the things that it could have been, all the special pleading, if you like, to kind of rescue our understanding. And it doesn't quite add up. And so that's disquieting for scientists, and it's leading to a lot of work. A lot of people are working on the impacts of that volcano. A lot of people are working on the impacts of the changes in sulfates. A lot of people are working on, you know, maybe the connection between very random weather events that just happen to all happen at the same time. Maybe it was just like a 1 in 300 year event that we wouldn't have seen in the observations, but that maybe will occasionally occur. So we're looking to see, you know, was 2023 a blip? Was it driven by something that's going to go away? Or was there something different in how the system is reacting to change that might actually be a systematic change that we're going to see going forward?
So we've looked at all these possible inputs, and they don't add up to what happened. They're just not on a big enough scale. So it still could be a freak event which passes, but it could be a signal of something else. Now, when will you know which of those is the case?
You know, science works on multiple tracks all at once. So we have a new satellite that launched at the beginning of February that will start soon giving us information that we've never had before about the makeup of particles in the atmosphere. And that is going to be very useful in kind of constraining the models, and then we'll use the models, and then we'll go back and re-look at 2023, and then we'll change something else, and then we'll re-look at 2023. So that's ongoing. We are looking at the latest estimates of other kinds of air pollution. Those should be available imminently. They said January, and then they said February. Now it's March, but it will be April soon. But it will be available soon. We will be rerunning everything with those emissions. We're doing right now that comparison of the 80% cut in the marine shippings. There's a big coordinated effort to look at that. There's a coordinated effort to look at the impacts of the volcanoes, and you know, people are kind of digging into the internal variability, the weather components to see whether, well, maybe, you know, a little bit of something in the North Atlantic involving Saharan dust and something different happening in the Southern Ocean, something different happening in the tropics, maybe they all add up. And so we're working on all of those tracks. But then we're looking at the observations that are coming in now, right? So as I said, the warmth that we're seeing, you know, the last couple of months is actually much closer to what we expect. Right. So if that starts to fade as we go into the summer, because El Nino peaked in January. Right. So now it's been going down and it will probably disappear by the beginning of summer. And so if at the end of the summer, we're still seeing these crazy anomalies, then we'll be able to say, okay, well, it wasn't anything to do with the El Nino. It is something else that's going on. So we're going to be looking for that, and we'll have a sense, you know, by the late summer, I would say August, September, as to whether we need to worry about how to explain 2024 as well as 2023.
But in effect, there is a possibility that we are in uncharted territory, that there is something going on here which isn't a blip, and what should we worry about there? What does that mean?
Scientists worry about these things because we like not to be surprised. We like to feel that we understand what's going on. And every so often, the real world and the universe comes up with things that we haven't expected, and that generates a huge amount of anxiety, but then productivity in terms of moving the science forward. So I don't know that people need to be worried that kind of scientific activity is ongoing, but it really whether normal people should be worried about this really depends on how this gets resolved. Absent an answer, you know, lots of things are possible, which can be, you know, anxiety inducing. But I would say, well, let's wait and see. You know, people, very smart people, are working on this. We have good data that's going to come in. We have good modeling that's going to get done. People are going to focus on this, and we're going to have an answer. And it might not be very dramatic, but there's always a possibility that it could be. But I would wait until we see that answer before anybody starts panicking slightly too much.
So we should come back later in the year and ask you what you've discovered and how you can explain the fact that 2023, which I think you wrote, was the warmest year for 100,000 years. That's a long time.
Possibly. It's hard to say. Obviously, you don't have great annual data for 100,000 years ago. But the issue is, while there are parts of the world that within the Holocene, like this, the more recent period since the end of the Ice Age, there are parts of the world that are still warmer in the early Holocene than they are today, particularly the Arctic. You know, there are beaches there that were laid down like 8,000 years ago that are still totally encased in ice the whole time. So in the Arctic, particularly, we haven't reached the warmth that we saw in the early Holocene. But the Arctic is not the whole world, and if we look at the global picture, it looks like we have exceeded the temperatures in the early Holocene. And if you go back, obviously, before the early Holocene, it was the Ice Age, and it was an Ice Age for 100,000 years. And so the previous warm period was about 120,000 years ago. And so it's conceivable on a global scale that what we've been seeing in recent decades and particularly last year exceeds any particular year in the early Holocene. And so the next warmest year would be back 120,000 years ago. We are a geological force.
Dr. Gavin Schmidt, Director of NASA's Goddard Institute. Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk or to our app, where you can read my feature, plus Gavin Esler on GB News, Miles Ellingham on Look for Rathman, Peter Kellner's analysis of the latest polls, and much, much more. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.
Hold up. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.